Welcome. I'm Michael Clarke. I'm here in the cabin of HMS Victory in Portsmouth, Nelson's flagship. And I'm joined by Dr. Gregory Fremont Barnes, who is the senior lecturer in war studies at the Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst. He's a noted author on Nelson, the Royal Navy, Nelson's campaigns, particularly the Battle of the Nile. But of course, when we sit in this cabin, we always think about Trafalgar. And in a sense, he planned the battle from here, the final details of the battle from this cabin. And he died a few metres away, a couple of decks below, on the orlop deck at the age of 47. And so this cabin seems resonant with history and atmosphere. Gregory, here we are in Nelson's cabin. It's for a naval analyst like yourself. This is quite a place to sit, isn't it?
Oh, it's brilliant. I mean, this is the greatest relic, really, of the age of fighting sail and, you know, Nelson's flagship. And as you say, where he died, where the iconic Battle of Trafalgar was fought. So it's a great pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it sort of oozes charisma. I mean, let's start. Let's talk about Nelson's charisma. I mean, we'll talk about his campaigns later on. But just this man, this character, you know, to serve him was to love him, it was always said. Was he always that charismatic?
Even as a young officer, I mean, as a lieutenant in the 1780s, he was quite admired by the lower decks. But that, I think that charisma grew in time with his confidence. And certainly by the time he was an admiral or vice admiral at Trafalgar, he was adored by his men. And they wept openly at his death, which was not uncommon in the 18th century for men. But that wouldn't have happened for most commanders. He was beloved in a way that, say, contemporaries like Wellington weren't. They were respected as commanders, but Nelson commanded enormous passion and loyalty from his crews.
When he was a young captain, and people used to remark on how young a captain he was when he was in these fifth and sixth rate frigates, these smaller frigates, and he was famous that he used to run up the ratlines with the midshipmen, because the midshipmen had to run up the ratlines, and he would run up the ratlines, A, to prove that the captain would do whatever they had to do, and B, that it wasn't that difficult. And that's, I mean, he was full of those sorts of theatrical flourishes, wasn't he?
Yes, he was a bit of a showman, highly energetic physically. He liked to make an example for the crews, whatever rank he was, whether it was midshipman, lieutenant, captain, and admiral. So that was very much his trademark, running up the rat lines. He was a self-publicist as well, and was conspicuous by wanting to draw attention to himself. So that suited him.
Yeah. Now, and you know, didn't he always have, from the very beginning of his career, or very near the beginning of his career, a sense that he was a bit special? I mean, he always, you know, destiny is a word that attaches to him, but increasingly in his life, he sees he has a destiny. But that seems to start quite early. It's a big word to use, but he seems to have a sense of himself as important to the Navy. And as he goes through his career, he thinks he's important to Great Britain as well. And he was right.
Yes, this comes out in his correspondence, and there are thousands of his letters extant. And he's, of course, never meant for publication. So I think we can look at them as honest expressions of his views to family, to fellow officers, and so forth. And he very much talks about his sense of the important part he can play in the war against France. And yes, I think he saw himself on a path to an important destiny for the nation.
Mm. And he trusts his own judgment all the time. I mean, he becomes quite, he's a nuisance to the Admiralty when he's on the West Indies station over enforcing the Navigation Acts, along with Collingwood and Collingwood's brother. The three of them were enforcing the Navigation Acts. And a lot of the plantation owners didn't want that.
Yes.
They wanted the Navigation Acts to be ignored. And, you know, Collingwood and Nelson, they pester the Admiralty. And the Admiralty think they're a damn nuisance. But Nelson is convinced that he's going to do this.
Yes, he believes in, well, to a certain extent, in upholding maritime law. So the Navigation Acts to which you refer was after the War of American Independence. In the 1780s, he was on the West India station, and the laws meant that American traders could not trade in the West Indies. Yeah. Only British ships could do so. And Nelson enforced that and seized cargoes, British and American, to uphold that, and that irritated the planters and members of the Admiralty.
And when he comes back to Britain, comes back with a wife, Fanny Nisbet, mm-hmm. and that's not a great success, of course, as mm-hmm. a marriage. But mm-hmm. when he comes back to Britain, he's not. He's on half pay. He's been paid off. The ship's paid off. And he's not very popular in the Admiralty at that stage because he's a young whippersnapper.
Yes. So he's unemployed for 5 years up to 1793 when the war with mm-hmm. France begins, the French Revolutionary Wars. Yes. And no, he doesn't have a sound reputation mm-hmm. as such.
And 1793, this 12 years begins right through to 1805, this tumultuous 12 years, mm-hmm. which catapults him from a clever young fella who is not really particularly well regarded at the Admiralty to this national hero, this 12 years. Mm-hmm. And it's dominated by three great naval campaigns. And I'd like to sort of talk about mm-hmm. each of them in turn. I mean, you know about them a lot better than I do. But the first one is the Battle of Cape St. Vincent. Mm-hmm. So John Jarvis, who became Earl St. Vincent, is leading a squadron south, and a much bigger squadron is coming north, big Spanish squadron that outnumbers him almost 2-1. They blunder into each other in the fog. The enemy are in two columns, loose columns. Jarvis finds himself going in the middle of the columns, and he tries a quite a difficult maneuver to turn the whole thing round in a big sort of snake going round about so that he can engage. But it looks as if he's left it too late. And it looks as if the whole thing is the battle's going to slip out of his fingers. And third from the end of this snake that Jarvis has created is Nelson. In the captain, and he breaks ranks, he disobeys orders, and he throws himself at the nearest Spanish column that's going past him. And Collingwood and Towery follow him in, Trowbridge gets there in the Culloden, and the four of them end up engaging a much bigger force. And this is the melee, this is the chaos that Nelson glories in, but my goodness, it was risky. So just tell us what Nelson does in this astonishing
yes.
operation.
So as you say, I mean, he's third to the in the vessel, third to the rear, and the captain, and he is an unorthodox tactician. He doesn't believe actually that line ahead, the traditional 18th century tactic of positioning your ships, you know, bow to stern in a line and meeting the broadsides of the enemy at close quarters is really the best tactic, because that's an attritional battle. And although the gunnery of British crews is superior, you're simply going to pound yourself in, perhaps pound the enemy into submission. But there are so many indecisive battles of the 18th century that Nelson feels he needs to take the initiative and be unorthodox. He breaks ranks, he sails to the Spanish detachment. His idea is to ensure that they don't unite, because the Spanish strategy is to meet up with the French further north and invade Britain. This is in February 1797. So there are two great invasion scares, that and the one of 1804-05. We'll talk about that later. And Nelson thinks, no, I want to engage in, a pell-mell battle, by which he means to penetrate the enemy line, or at least bring British vessels on either side of the Spanish in this case and overwhelm them. The idea is the Spanish have a numerical superiority of 27, I think, to 15 ships of the line. The only way really of defeating them, even though their crews are inferior, the Spanish, they well outgun the British, is to concentrate on a specific part of the Spanish line and not engage in a line ahead tactic.
And in the chaos, the San Nicolas and the San Jose crash up against each other, and Nelson brings the captain, his ship, right up to the starboard quarter of the San Nicolas. And then these three ships are locked together.
Right.
And this is what makes him the darling of the nation, isn't it?
Yes, because he leads a boarding party, and this is archetypal Nelson leading from the front, and he's physically a very brave man.
And he breaks through the stern windows of the San Nicolas. He goes in through the windows into the cabin of the San Nicolas and fights his way with sword in hand up onto the quarterdeck.
Indeed, as if it were infantry. And in fact, he was taking infantry and Marines with him.
Yeah.
It gets up onto the deck, captures that vessel, and then crosses over to the deck of the next Spanish ship. So of the four that were captured, two of them were taken by Nelson. And this, although John Jarvis does not mention this in his dispatch back to the Admiralty, Nelson decides, he's going to approach an author and make sure that the nation the knows that he's done this.
Okay. So then we go to the Mediterranean and the Battle of the Nile, which is second great operation, 1798. And Napoleon has set off from Toulon with a major squadron. Nobody knows what it's going to do. Nelson spends 3 months trawling the Mediterranean trying to find it. He has a strategic vision. He always thought that Napoleon would go for Alexandria for an Egyptian campaign to open a land route to India and make himself into a global player. And he's right about that because he discovers the French in Aboukir Bay, and you've written specifically on the Battle of the Nile. And so then this is Nelson adopting risky tactics, isn't it?
It is. So he's trying to pursue the French in the Mediterranean. At first, he's not sure it's Egypt, but ultimately he does discover them in Aboukir Bay, which is east of Alexandria. The French have already taken Cairo because Napoleon has grand schemes for building an empire in the east and perhaps getting as far as India, ultimately. So Nelson, the squadron arrives on the evening of the 1st of August, 1798. It's nearly dark, and so there's a risk of a friendly fire, actually, and reconnoiters the bay, but only briefly. He is a man of action. He takes the initiative, wants to attack immediately, without having a full understanding of the strength of the French fleet. But he appreciates, largely through Captain Foley of the Goliath, that because the French are anchored largely inshore on the west side of the bay, there is room to maneuver on that side, the landward side. And the French have, many of the crews are on shore. The captains are at dinner with the admiral, although they do decamp to their own ships. And so as the British approach, they decide that the French ships are actually anchored by their bows, which means they can swing. And this means that British ships can move between them and attack them on the inshore side as well as the seaward side. And they're about equal in strength, about 14 ships of the line on either side, plus frigates. Nelson decides he will attack on the inshore side with about half of his squadron. That means that that side is unmanned. There are a lot of crates of stores and equipment on that side of the French line. And he'll break the line, again, an unorthodox tactic, not line ahead, which is going to pass down the ranks of the French line and cannonade them, but break through, and that allows you to so-called cross the T, to use your broadside against the most vulnerable part of an enemy vessel, the stern particularly, like where we're sitting now, or the bow, sending fire down the length of the decks.
Absolutely devastating.
Absolutely. Splinters and round shot can dismantle the long guns and the crews.
And the effect of this victory at the Nile, the strategic effect, is pretty considerable, isn't it?
It is.
This is Nelson having a strategic impact with his battles.
Yes. So this puts paid to Napoleon's ideas of conquest of India, which were probably fantastic anyway. But it also isolates the French army in Egypt. They have no way of escaping. And although they'll remain until 1801, a British army will arrive under Abercrombie at Alexandria and defeat the French. Napoleon will have returned to Europe independently, but it's a major setback for them. But also importantly, it allows the British, who had been forced out of the Mediterranean in 1796, really to dominate that sea as a Royal Navy lake again. Apart from the fact that the French still have ships at Toulon, the great Mediterranean port, they've largely retaken the Mediterranean, and that is very important.
Back in the Mediterranean, never to leave.
That's right. Yeah.
The third great operation was Copenhagen. We won't talk about that in any detail, except the issue. That was famously where Nelson claimed he couldn't see the signal.
Yes.
So his commander was giving him the signal to withdraw. He claimed he famously said he put the telescope to his defective eyes, I can't see anything.
Right.
This is Nelson being insubordinate, isn't it?
It is. So Sir Hyde Parker was admiral, commander of the Baltic Fleet. Nelson was his second in command and took 20 ships, the line, to attack the defenses at Copenhagen. So the British had numerical superiority, but the Danes had shore batteries as well, and they were very good gunners. this idea of I cannot see the signal comes from the fact that after several hours of hammering, and this is an attritional battle, Nelson's fleet is anchored and is very vulnerable to the fire of Danish gunnery, both on the land and at sea. They're taking a hammering, losing hundreds of men killed and wounded, and Sir Hyde Parker, who's quite indecisive, hoists the signal for Nelson to disengage. And Nelson decides he's having none of this. He can see that victory is within his grasp. And he'll know that the fleet will limp away and probably be heavily damaged if he attempts to disengage. But that's not in his character. He puts a telescope to his blind eye. He had been blinded at Calvi in 1794 during the siege in Corsica, and says, I simply cannot see the signal. And that's where we get the expression,
to turn a blind eye.
And he does get away with it. He, from the Nile, he's already the darling of the nation. So he can almost do no wrong. And in fact, the Admiralty replaces Parker with Nelson as commander of the Baltic Fleet thereafter.
Yeah. I always say that by this stage, Nelson was almost like an 18th century rock star. He has that public adulation. And just briefly, we must talk about Trafalgar, but his personal life was by then pretty complicated. It was public scandal because of his relationship with Lady Hamilton, and Lady Hamilton's husband. It was like a ménage à trois that they didn't really try to disguise.
Yes.
But he gets away with the scandal. He's ridiculed for it, but people still love him because he's a winner. Because he's a rock star in that society.
Yes, he was a true celebrity, particularly from the Nile. So after 1798 of the victory he sails to Naples. Emma Hamilton is married to Sir William Hamilton, who's the British ambassador in Naples and has been for many years. She's earned a certain respectability because of that connection, but she came from humble origins and was considered scandalous within British society, but not in Naples. And Nelson becomes enamored by her. She's an enormous fan of his. So at some point in 1799, he, having moved into the embassy with Sir William's agreement, he develops this relationship with Emma Hamilton. And his officers and the Admiralty had a very difficult time convincing him in 1800, after overstaying his time at Naples, to return to Britain.
We must get on to Trafalgar. It was a long campaign. Nelson is chasing Villeneuve and Gravina, the French and Spanish admirals, across the Atlantic to the West Indies. They attempt to draw the British fleet away so that a big combined French and Spanish fleet could occupy the channel so that that Napoleon, with 200,000 troops and 2,000 barges, could cross. I mean, that was the strategic context. But it all comes to a head off Cadiz, off Cape Trafalgar, in two tumultuous hours on the 21st of October. And I want to jump straight to the 21st of October, because this is where this cabin, in a sense, you know, comes into its own. The tactic that you've described, Nelson's tactic of wanting to annihilate the fleet, to take it out of the reckoning of any invasion plan, resolves itself into these two lines. He's going to attack this long line, 4 miles of broadsides, 2,500 guns, and he's going to attack it in two columns, him leading the north column, Collingwood the south. And this is his plan, isn't it?
Yes.
It's been done before, but this is Nelson's refinement of the plan.
Right. So this was developed in early October 1805. Yep. Again, it's an unorthodox approach, having two columns attacking the Franco-Spanish line. Now, Nelson has slight numerical inferiority. He has 27 ships of the line against the 33 of the French and Spanish. But as has been his precedent, he decides he's not going to use the traditional line ahead strategy. He wants to break through the line, specifically the center and rear of the enemy line. And the reason for this is there are adverse winds, so it's very difficult for the center and rear of the enemy to aid the van if it's attacked, but also the van is unable to reverse course and assist the...
And he thought he'd have enough time to annihilate the center and the rear of the column before the front of the column could join the battle.
Right.
It's a big risk, yes. But he took it, as always took the risk.
He is a great risk taker, and he penetrates, he and Collingwood, in these separate columns, the line, as at St. Vincent, Nelson goes for the flagship, the Bosanteur. That's just his way. And having broken through the line, many of the British ships are sometimes double-shotted, firing round shot or grape shot into the stern windows, as is here, down the decks of the enemy vessels. Of course, they're taking, particularly Collingwood and Nelson, which are the lead vessels, take a bit of a pummeling, approaching the convex line, because of course they're under fire for quite a long time, about an hour, and they're unable to return fire because their bows are facing the enemy, not their broadsides. But once they get their broadsides in action, British gunnery is far superior, particularly against the Spanish. Because remember, these vessels, the enemy vessels, had largely been confined to port, blockaded by the British. Not just at Toulon, but in Cadiz and in Ferrol, in Brest, all along the Atlantic and Mediterranean coasts. So the crews are not very well trained. Mm. They're not exercised.
Exactly. And this dangerous run-in that starts about 1,000 yards out, this run-in against these 2,500 guns, 4 miles of broadside, this is where this cabin, in a sense, comes back into the history. Because about half an hour before the first salvos are fired, Nelson comes down to this cabin and he writes a letter and a prayer, and he finishes that prayer by saying, "To him I resign myself and the just cause which is entrusted to me. Amen, amen, amen." And then he gets up and he kneels down beside his writing desk and prays for a while. And then he goes upstairs where the first salvos are about to land. And this sense that he knew he wasn't coming back, this is very prevalent in that on that day, isn't it? Before they break the line behind the French flagship, he sort of knows, doesn't he, or feels in his heart that he won't be coming back.
I think he does. I think he knows that this is the culminating battle of the war. Even though the war is going to extend to 1814, Trafalgar really finishes any French naval aspirations after that. And, you know, the iconic signal, "England expects that every man will do his duty." I think he thinks that's probably one of the last signals he will issue. And indeed it is. But he also issues the signal, you know, that to engage the enemy more closely. In other words, he very much understands that the superiority of his crews, their morale, their leadership, their motivation, their seamanship, their gunnery skills are what's going to turn the battle.
Yeah.
Because it... Again, a bit like St. Vincent, it deteriorates into a melee, and with superior gunnery and discipline holding sway. And this will result in something like a battle of annihilation, really, almost like the Nile, not quite as impressive. Of the 33 ships, 18 are captured or burned, and then another 4 are captured, I think, the following day. So it's an enormous victory. Yeah. But I think you're right. I don't know if I could go so far as to say he had a death wish, but it was natural in his personality that he should die in battle. You know, resplendent in his full dress uniform on the quarter deck of the Victory, shot by a French sniper from the mizzen tops of the Rey du Table, which was astride the Victory. And I mean, he was a Christian, but he was a flawed character, because we've talked about Emma Hamilton. But he was very religious, and I think he thought duty first and dying for the nation in an age of heroism. Yeah. What I mean by that is this is what the nation expected of its leaders. And they were, you know, Britain had been at war with France intermittently, but for many of the years of the 18th century, since the days of Louis XIV in the late 1690s, until the Napoleonic Wars, until Waterloo, 10 years after Trafalgar. And so there was a sense that you needed courage and displayed in battle, but loyalty to the nation, and dying was considered part and parcel of that.
And so his life comes to an end on the orlop deck here, on the 21st of October, 1805, at the age of 47. He had everything to live for after Trafalgar, but he just never believed he would. He would have had fame, fortune, a life with Emma Hamilton, his young daughter. But he just never believed really in his heart that he would enjoy them. And so what sort of commander was he compared to others? I mean, a lot of people have said, oh, we need the Nelson touch. How often do you hear, we need the Nelson touch? Beatty in Jutland in 1916 felt he had the Nelson touch. He wanted to be like Nelson. Can we compare Nelson to other commanders? How did he compare to other commanders?
I think it's very difficult. I think Nelson was probably unique in terms of his charisma, his leadership qualities, the fact that he was not only respected, but loved by his crews and fellow officers, his band of brothers, which has really developed by the time of the Battle of the Nile and is still operating by the time of Trafalgar. And that makes it very difficult for Royal Naval officers or any sailor post-1805 to mimic.
Yeah.
You're aspiring to a standard that's almost unachievable. His reputation is almost, in military terms and naval terms, almost unassailable.
But he had immense power as a three-star admiral.
Yes.
As a vice admiral. He had more power than any vice admiral would have these days.
Yes, he did. And that's partly for technological reasons, yeah, in the sense that, you know, now we have instantaneous communication. The way in which admirals operate now means that they receive and orders in moments, and they can issue them in that way. Nelson was operating hundreds of miles away from London. It took weeks for him to receive orders and for his dispatches to arrive at the Admiralty. That gave him a huge amount of independence and personal initiative. So he could make decisions, unorthodox decisions many times, without risk of criticism at the moment by the Admiralty or to be told otherwise. And even at Copenhagen, Parker issues the signal to withdraw and Nelson ignores it, but there's nothing he can do, nothing Parker can actually do about it. When he's at Trafalgar or you know, further afield, he's free to make decisions, and modern commanders cannot do that.
And what about just in terms of his legacy? We should deal with Trafalgar first. I mean, the significance of Trafalgar. It didn't stop an invasion of Britain because Napoleon had already called it off 2 days before, but it was strategically important, wasn't it, Trafalgar?
Yes. So the French had intended to invade in the late summer of 1805, and they had, as you said, a massive army at Boulogne and elsewhere along the Channel coast. But that was called off because of the hostility of Austria and Russia. So the Grande Armée, Napoleon's main force, moved east to the Danube Valley and fought the Battle of Austerlitz at the end of 1805. That meant that the invasion of Britain was no longer imminent. But it did still mean that the fleets existed, Villeneuve's and Gravina's, the Spanish commanders, and there were others at Brest and Cherbourg and elsewhere. Those could unite and assist Marshal Massena, who was a French commander in Italy. And so the fleet was meant to sail into the Mediterranean before it was attacked by Nelson off Cape Trafalgar. That is no longer possible, obviously, because nearly the entire fleet is annihilated. That means that Spain is effectively knocked out of the war. France no longer has a dominant position in the Mediterranean. But in a wider way, Trafalgar means that France is, in a maritime sense, now isolated for the rest of the war. It doesn't have the trade connections it formerly had, particularly with its West Indian colonies, which are very lucrative, sugar particularly. It means that Britain is the maritime leader for the next century and more. And that will enable uninhibited trade and the expansion of the empire, because there's no other rival at sea in terms of commerce or in maritime strength.
And that's it. Trafalgar didn't stop an invasion of Britain, but it changed the strategic balance in Britain's favor, and particularly the Royal Navy's favor, for a very long time.
Yes, it has a profound impact on the land campaign of the Napoleonic Wars, because Wellington's campaigns from 1808 to 14 in Iberia, in Portugal and Spain, in southern France, could only have been possible, those strings of victories, if Britain had control of the sea, which dates back to Trafalgar, because of supply lines to the peninsula. Spain and Portugal could not supply, even though they were friendly with British troops there to oust the French, they could not supply the needs of Wellington's army. The Navy does.
Okay, Gregory, we have to finish now, but in a sentence, what does Nelson mean to you?
I think
in a phrase, in an idea, you've lived with this man for a long time. What does he mean to you?
I think he kind of exemplifies patriotic duty, leading from the front, physical bravery, a sort of moral, not a moral ascendancy, because he was definitely flawed, but an archetypal officer. He was very charismatic. Men were prepared to follow him anywhere. He was a brilliant tactician. Yeah. And unorthodox, but successful. And he embodied so many of the main principles of modern leadership that we admire and we teach at Sandhurst and at Dartmouth and at other institutions of that kind.
Dr. Gregory Fremont Barnes, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.